I'll try to use it as far as I, as much as I can, because it's probably the only time in my life I'll be like using one of this. Not sure I will get to the end of this. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me. And I'll be discussing today the role of magnetic reconnection in giving non-thermal particles in two systems, pulsar winds and relativistic jets. This is the closest system where we have evidence of magnetic reconnection. This is the solar corona. And magnetic reconnection is thought to power these giant flares, restructuring of the field topology, which is also associated with energy being released from the fields and given to the particles. Particles, either thermal particles or non-thermal particles. This will be the closest object, but I won't be discussing the sun any longer. I will concentrate on stride pulsar winds and jets throughout my talk. At the end of my talk, I will get to the a little bit more into the strong gravity regime, which I think is of most interest for this group, and emphasize that magnetic reconnection can actually be important at that point as well. And a lot of the physics and the mechanics of reconnection that we study in pulsar winds and in jets can actually be applied to binary neutron star mergers in the late stages of evolution, for example. A brief outline of my talk. I will be discussing non-thermal emission in pulsar wind nebulae and relativistic jets, just to emphasize what is the observational signatures that we would like to understand and explain. The physics of magnetic reconnection, and in particular, the role of magnetic reconnection in stride pulsar winds and jets. And then the mechanism of particle acceleration, so a particular emphasis on the role of particle acceleration in magnetic reconnection, again, pulsar winds and jets will be the primary focuses of my discussion. I'll be varying the parameters and the properties of the flow and understand the trends and conclude with the astrophysical implications. So what are pulsars? I need to define what a pulsar is before talking about pulsar wind nebulae. Pulsars are magnetized rotating neutron stars. You have a rotational axis, which is vertical here, that is not aligned with the magnetic axis. The magnetic axis can point towards the Earth once every rotation period, and you can see beamed radio emission coming towards you. You stack the radio peaks that you see as a function of the phase in the rotation period of the pulsar, and the peaks may appear and disappear, but once you average them, then you obtain a remarkably stable pulsed profile. So a pulsar is a rotating neutron star that is periodically emitting a radio beam towards the observer, towards the Earth. Pulsars are known to be losing their energy. Their rotational energy is lost. The way we measure this is by measuring their period and the period derivative, the so-called PP dot diagram, and pulsars are just stacked onto this diagram. By measuring the period and the period derivative and knowing or guessing the moment of inertia of the neutron star, you can measure the spin down rate, the spin down luminosity. How much energy is the pulsar losing just because its P, its period is changing. And it turns out that the energy that is lost due to the spin down is most only modestly contributed by the energy lost in radiation. So the radiation energy loss is at most 10% of the spin down power. So most of the energy goes somewhere else, and we believe that the energy losses are leaving the pulsar as a magnetized relativistic wind, which is called the pulsar wind. So what happens to the pulsar wind? The pulsar wind is starting from the pulsar, streaming out at relativistic velocities, and eventually impacting the surrounding medium and forming a shock at that point. This is my best picture, because picture that I took of the Crab Nebula, which is a prototypical example of pulsar wind nebulae. This is actually not a Crab Nebula, this is water in my sink, but the physics is exactly the same. You have water streaming out from the center, the water is actually getting down this way and then streaming out, and when the run pressure of the water is balancing the pressure of the surrounding, you form a shock here, and this will be the termination shock for the pulsar wind nebula. This is the real image of the Crab Nebula. The features are remarkably similar. This will be the stream of water. That's not true. And you have the relativistic wind of the pulsar, which is streaming out here. And where the ram pressure of the wind is balancing the surrounding pressure of the nebula, you form a shock. We call this termination shock. And observationally, we identify this inner ring region with the termination shock of the pulsar wind nebula. The termination shock is supposed to be accelerating particles and eventually releasing radiation to give this non-thermal spectrum. The spectrum of the Crab Nebula, which is our best example of pulsar-wind nebulae is a very broadband spectrum that is extending from the radio band up to TeV energies or gamma ray energies. It's characterized by two big bumps. The low energy signature, the low energy component, is believed to be synchrotron, particles in magnetic fields, relativistic particles in magnetic fields. The high energy component, which is this one, is believed to be inverse Compton by the same relativistic electrons that are upscattering soft photons. Very broadband spectrum, and it's definitely not a thermal spectrum, not compatible with a Planck distribution, but it's often characterized by power law components. Power law in a log-log space appear as linear, with a linear slope. So this is one power law component in the radio band and a different power law component in the X-ray band. And the luminosity as a function of frequency goes like nu to the minus 0.3 for the radio part of the spectrum and steeper, nu to the minus 1.1 for the X-ray part of the spectrum. The other thing is that magnetic fields have to play a role here. We do see radio and optical polarization in the crab. So the magnetic fields are important for the emission and may actually be important for the dynamics of the flow itself. So we have a configuration where magnetic fields are definitely important. The same is true not only for pulsar-wind nebulae, but also for AGN jets, jets from active galactic nuclei streaming out of a central engine, which can be a black hole, with relativistic velocities. And then we identify in the radio these blobs where we think the dissipation is happening. So it's still unsure what is the real dissipation mechanism operating there, but the, whatever dissipation process is at work, it should produce a non-thermal spectrum as this one. So again, two broad components, a low energy component and a high energy component. The low energy component is dominated by synchron radiation. The high energy component is dominated by inverse Compton radiation. And in general, the same way as for the Crab Nebula or for pulsar-wind nebulae, we have a power law component in the photon spectrum, and this has to correspond to a power law component in the particle distribution. So we need to find a mechanism that is responsible for producing power law populations in the electron distribution, and electrons will eventually be emitting radiation in a power law way. What is the primary mechanism that could be responsible for generating non-thermal distribution of electrons with a power law energy spectrum? We think the reconnection may be one of them. And this is my picture of reconnection 101. 101 is a course that you take in the first year in college, where you think that when you still believe that your professor knows everything. And this is my simple picture of reconnection. You have fields of one polarity, red here, and fields of the opposite polarity, blue here, and they meet in the center. These are called reconnecting fields. The fields are advected into the center by the motions of plasmas. In the center, the curl of B is giving rise to a current, and if the change, if the curl of B is happening on a scale that is very, very small, then the current needs to be very, very large, and at some point, the plasma cannot just sustain such a current against the resistivity of the plasma itself. So when this happens, we have reconnection. The fields are reconnecting, so half blue, half red, and they're escaping on the two sides of the reconnection region. The center of this region is called X point for obvious reasons. And the dynamics is shown here. Field lines are advected into the center together with the plasma velocity. So the plasma is getting in, and the plasma is released along these two directions. So getting in into this direction and escaping along this direction. Together with the magnetic field, together with the plasma velocity, we have an electric field that is just coming out from the V cross B product. So velocity and magnetic field, we have an advection electric field. The electric field is present everywhere, but it's most important at the X point. It's just because at the X point, the magnetic field is very small, so the electric field can actually have an appreciable effect on the particle motion and the dynamics of the particle acceleration at that point. So magnetic reconnection 101. Now let's go one step further, and this will be magnetic reconnection 201. And I will focus now in particular on relativistic reconnection. And by relativistic reconnection, I mean a regime in which the magnetization parameter sigma is much larger than unity. Sigma is defined as the ratio of the magnetic energy to the rest mass energy of the plasma, or in general, the kinetic energy of the plasma. But here we start with plasma at rest. So a large magnetization means that the Magnetic energy in the plasma is over-dominating with respect to the rest mass energy. The energy available per particle is much larger than its own rest mass, just because most of the energy is in the magnetic fields. In this particular configuration, the same picture applies. You have field lines coming into the reconnection region from two opposite sides with different polarities. You have an X point in between, and between the inflow region and the outflow region, you have two oblique shocks. Shocks are jumps in density, pressure, and temperature, and you can solve for the jumps by imposing the conservation of mass and the conservation of energy across the shock. And what you get is that across those oblique shocks, the jump conditions are such that the outflow of the plasma in the outflow region is relativistic in the regime sigma much larger than unity, and the bulk Lorentz factor of the plasma goes like the square root of the magnetization, and the plasma is also hot. The temperature of the plasma in its comoving frame in the outflow region is scaling as the square root of the magnetization again. So square root of the magnetization here and there, the plasma is moving relativistically, and it's also relativistically hot. On the other hand, this solution requires that the inflow rate, the rate at which the plasma flows into the reconnection region, is only non-relativistic, and regardless of sigma, it's around 0.1 or so. And this has been tested with simulations, and it seems to be a solid result. So reconnection in relativistic flows or relativistic reconnection cannot proceed at a rate that is higher than 0.1 of the speed of light or so. When you say it's 2D. But I'll be discussing a lot about 2D versus 3D in the later part of my talk, so feel free to ask the question again. The best way to test this would be to do a 2D simulation, but it's not necessarily the most realistic way of testing this. In 3D, there is additional physics which can break this purely two-dimensional picture and complicate things significantly. So 201, and now let's go to 501. 501 is what you take in graduate school when now you know that your professor doesn't know everything. And in particular, the one thing that we don't know about reconnection is that we're not sure whether reconnection can produce non-thermal particles and what is the distribution that we should expect for the non-thermal particles. As a reminder, we do need non-thermal particles with a distribution being a power law to explain, for example, the radio component or the X-ray component of the Crab Nebula, which are power laws in photon energy. So we do need power laws in particle energy. And in particular, the one thing that is highly unknown is what is the distribution of the accelerated particles. Here, dn over d gamma is the differential distribution of particles as a function of the Lorentz factor or energy, scaling like energy or Lorentz factors to the minus p. And this p is currently unknown. There are analytical tools to explore what is p for magnetic reconnection, but different authors are getting different answers, and there doesn't seem to be an agreement on that. And simulations are also giving different results depending on different groups and different setups of the simulations. On the left side, here I'm showing the energy distribution obtained by Zenitani and Oshino in 2007, multiplied by gamma. So this distribution multiplied by the Lorentz factor of the particles, and you get a power law tail with an index of 2.4 or so. But the slope depends on the time where you look at your simulation. It may actually be getting steeper with time or flatter with time. That's not a generic result. And if you look into the reconnection region very close to the X point, the slope may actually be flatter. The dotted line is what you get in the reconnection region. So no generic answer. And it's not even sure that you'll have a non-thermal distribution. Different authors are claiming that reconnection can actually give you a Maxwellian distribution or something that looks like a Maxwellian. So in at early stages, it can be physical in the sense that the reconnection process is sensitive to the initial conditions, which are physical, of the structure of the reconnection layer, for example. It can also be affected by the boundary conditions of your simulations. So if you evolve the simulation such that at some point you're limited by your boundary conditions, then this effect on the slope may well come from the boundary conditions of your simulations.
But
It could be tested by running a bigger simulation.
Or smaller.
Or smaller.
And so then what can we believe?
Those papers were, I don't recall seeing a test on the convergence of the results on the size of the box. I may be wrong for that result, but that's my recall.
And this also was in 2D?
Both of them were in 2D. So this is what we don't know about reconnection. And the fundamental way to approach this problem and to understand what's going on in the reconnection layer and what is going on especially for the particle acceleration is to perform particle-in-cell simulation. Particle-in-cell method is a very simple method, very basics. It basically only involves Maxwell's equations and the Lorentz force. The Maxwell's equations are solved on a grid using as source term the currents that are deposited by the particles. There are charged macroparticles that are living in the simulations. Their currents are deposited on the grid, and the electromagnetic fields are solved on the grid, and the fields are then used to advance the position of the particles over time. And the loop is closed self-consistently. So Lorentz force plus Maxwell's equations, there's nothing simpler than that. The good thing is that we are capturing the plasma physics at a very fundamental level. On the other hand, we're limited to very small scales. The plasma scales are typically very small, and this requires huge simulations, and we are only limited to a very small times, which is typically very small than astrophysical time scales. Tristan MP is the code that we're using.
Sorry, that method includes
relativistic effect. Yes, it's a relativistic code, special relativistic. Okay, so the first objects that we'll be focusing our attention on are pulsar wind nebulae. And the picture here is just meant to illustrate the fact that we do have in pulsar winds this alternation of the polarity of the field. The field is going in one direction here as shown by the arrows, and in the other direction here, there will be a current sheet in between where reconnection can happen and give particle acceleration. Let's not look at the jet case yet. We'll be looking at this afterwards. And this is just an illustration. It's a force-free simulation showing the wind emanating out of the pulsar with this alternation of the magnetic fields. And once the wind gets to the termination shock, which is very far from the pulsar, the wind will be advecting fields of opposite polarity into the termination shock. And in particular, there will be a region within the equatorial plane, close to the equatorial plane of the pulsar, if the pulsar rotational axis and magnetic axis are not aligned, where the magnetic field is alternating its polarity, out of the board, into the board, out of the board, with the pulsar period. And once the fields are vectored into the shock, it will be interesting to study the interaction of these alternating fields with the termination shock. And that will be the purpose of my discussion here. The setup of our simulations is shown here. This is, again, a sketch of the pulsar wind. And we'll be taking a cut through the pulsar wind with the x-axis in the radial direction, the y-axis in the toroidal direction. This will be our simulation plane, 2D so far, but we'll be discussing some 3D results afterwards, showing the essential agreement. Otherwise, I wouldn't be discussing 2D. We set up an upstream medium, which is moving relativistically towards the downstream. The simulation is performed in the downstream frame. We choose an electron positron plasma because it's currently believed that pulsar winds are mostly made of electron positron pairs. The flow is moving relativistically. The upstream flow is moving relativistically with a bulk Lorentz factor gamma zero. We define the magnetization of the upstream flow as the ratio of magnetic energy to kinetic energy, larger than unity, much larger than unity, as appropriate for the pulsar winds. And we can change the stripe wavelength, which is set by the rotation rate of the pulsar. So it's essentially changing the rotation frequency of the pulsar. The wavelength is expressed in units of the plasma scale, the plasma, so-called plasma skin depth, which is a combination of the Lorentz factor and the density of the plasma. So this is the fundamental scale for plasma physics, and it will be appearing over and over again. And the other thing that we can change is change the relative width of the red region relative to the blue region at fixed overall wavelength. The red region being larger can give us a field averaged over one stripe that is non-zero. If the two regions have the same width, then the fields averaged over one stripe will be zero, but it doesn't necessarily need to be zero. And in particular, if you're away from the midplane, you'll see that this region with positive field is actually smaller than the region with negative field. So you do expect such a configuration to be present in the pulsar wind. Our setup is shown here. One wavelength in which the field is alternating. This is the field in the simulation plane. And I'm showing here the density averaged over the transverse direction of the simulation and the magnetic energy averaged over the transverse direction. And this is the orientation of the simulation plane relative to the pulsar wind. The flow is advected to the left. Even though the box is enlarging to the right, the flow is actually moving to the left. The stripes are advected towards this left boundary of the box. The first thing that you notice in the density is that the density jumps at this shock. So this will be the termination shock of the pulsar wind. In our case, the density jumps is compatible with MHT jump conditions. The most important thing and the most interesting thing actually happens for the magnetic energy. So the magnetic energy initially goes up, as you would expect from MHT just compression, and then it actually decays behind the shock. So there is some process which is taking the energy away from the fields and putting it into something else. And this something else is particles. If you plot the particle phase space here, this is the projection of the particle momentum along the direction of propagation of the shock. So x is the direction of propagation of the shock. And we see that the particle energy or momentum ahead of the shock is much smaller than the particle energy behind the shock. So the particles are hot behind the shock, and this energy just came out of the field. So some process, we already know the answer by now, but some process is responsible for putting the energy that was initially in the fields into the particles at the shock.
These particles are the electrons and positrons that you mentioned.
Say it again?
These particles are the electrons.
Electrons and positrons, yes. So these are particles that are existing in the simulations and whose charge, whose currents is deposited on the grid to create the magnetic fields and vice versa. No, there are no collisions of particles or annihilation processes. It's a collisionless plasma, so Coulomb collisions are neglected and annihilation processes are neglected. And usually in the systems that we apply these simulations to, the collisionless approximation is usually a very good one.
Coulomb collisions that are smaller than one cell size are neglected.
In the simulations? Well, sure. On the other hand, the scales of the Coulomb collision will be the scales of the single electron. And here, we're only modeling macroparticles, which are the particles contained within one device sphere. So by construction, the Coulomb collisions are neglected. They will be happening on scales that are smaller than the scales of the particles here.
So the electromagnetic field associated to each of the particles, is it accounted for? Or is it, do you have an ambient magnetic field that
That's correct. So the magnetic field that I start with is something that I put in as initial conditions in my simulation. And the particle distribution as well is arranged such that this initial configuration is one solution. So for example, when changing the magnetic field from negative to positive here, then I also set up a current in between such that to sustain the curl of the magnetic field. But that's something that we put in by hand. So once this initial condition that is only established at the very right boundary of the box is guaranteed, then the flow after that is just rearranging currents and magnetic fields depending on what are the plasma, what the self-consistent plasma processes want. Good. Energy transfer from the fields to the particles. And now I would like to look at the two-dimensional structure of the flow, so that the previous plot was for a two-dimensional simulations, but in 1D, and this is in 2D, I'm plotting density here, the magnetic energy, and the alternating magnetic field. So this is the same plot as before. And we'll follow this over time, and you see two structures. You have one shock that we'll be calling the fast shock that is propagating into the upstream region, and once it encounters a current sheet, it's compressing the current sheet, and start reconnection. And reconnection appears as these characteristic islands in the density and in the magnetic energy. These small scale islands are eventually merging and getting bigger over time as more particles are getting into the islands. And eventually the size of the island becomes comparable to the distance between two neighboring current sheets. And at that point, the process is forced to stop. So when the island size is becoming comparable to the separation, there are no more stripes downstream of that region. And this is actually a second shock. This is the density discontinuity that you were seeing before. A second shock is formed here, which is different than this shock propagating into the upstream medium at early times. And very little magnetic energy is left behind this second shock.
But this growth of islands, isn't that very much tied to the fact that you're going into the 3D?
Let's get to that later. So this is a two-dimensional simulation, and we do see the tearing mode in 2D. If we were to do a three-dimensional simulation, you would be seeing the tearing mode in the same plane where the 2D simulation is done, and then some other modes in the other direction. And then the question is, what is the competition of the two modes and who's winning in that case? But I'll be getting there. So tearing mode is operating here and responsible for the island formation and merging. And there is one X point in between each pair of islands, the same X point that I've mentioned before, where the reconnection is actually happening. This is a snapshot showing the same structure as before. We have a fast shock here that is propagating into the upstream, compressing the current sheet, creating the islands. The islands are merging on the way towards the left, and they're getting bigger over time. And when their size is comparable to the distance between two current sheets, then the striped structure of the flow is completely erased, and the downstream flow doesn't care anymore about having been striped in the first place. This shock I call hydroshock because there is very little magnetic energy behind it. So this shock effectively behaves as being driven by only particle pressure behind it. It's moving at one-third of the speed of light, as you would expect for a non-magnetized shock, relativistic shock. It's also interesting to follow the evolution of the particle spectrum as you get closer to the shock. And here, this is what I'm showing, the particle spectrum in the current sheet. Initially, it starts with a relatively hot distribution, but not extending very far in energy. And as you get closer to the shock, from yellow to black, there is an increasing population of high energy particles, and eventually in the post-shock medium, you get the black spectrum here, which is a very broad spectrum. The black here is the same as the black here, and it can clearly not be fitted with a Maxwellian distribution. This would be a Maxwellian with the same energy as the black spectrum, the same average energy as the black spectrum, but it quite closely follows a power law distribution with an index of 1.5. So we're showing here that reconnection happening on the way from the fast shock to the hydro shock can give you a power law distribution with a spectral index of 1.5. This is the firm statement of reconnection in pulsar winds. And now I would like to convince you of why we create such a broad distribution. In order to create a broad distribution, we need both particle getting very high energies and particle staying relatively cold. So how can we explain this coexistence of two different kinds of particles, or two different evolutionary behaviors for the particles? I'm here distinguishing particles depending on their final energy. Red particles for red color for particles that will not get very high in energy, and yellow color for particles that will eventually be accelerated to very high energies. And here I'm showing the same particles from the simulation in the two-dimensional plot of the density, same color. So yellow for particles that will eventually be getting high energies, and red for particles that don't get that much. So this is the same simulation as before, and we selected particles such that they were starting from the same x location, so from the same x position here, randomly. So there are actually more particles that I'm plotting here, and the selection is done in energy. So I'm saying, let's select the particles that will get to very high energy, and let's select some particles randomly that will get to very low energies only, and then I'm overplotting them here. So there is no criterion in saying the yellow particles should be here and the red particles should be here. But this is actually what comes out, and this is where the physics is. So let's follow them over time, and there is one critical moment in which the particles are interacting with a current sheet that is determining their subsequent evolution, and it's exactly now. So what you see is that right before the particles, the yellow particles will be accelerated, they're all concentrated in between the magnetic islands, apart from these two guys, they will also get there. That's where the X point is. So that's where the magnetic energy is released, is given to the particles. That's the preferred location for having particle acceleration because the electric field is the strongest there relative to the magnetic field. And in fact, the yellow particles will be boosted up in energy. The red particles are trapped in the magnetic islands. They won't get to the X point. They won't get to very high energy because they don't cross the region that is the best for efficient and fast acceleration. That's where the different behavior is coming from the red, for the red and the yellow particles.
The yellow ones, after being boosted, they also end up in the island?
Yes. By the electric field. So in principle, I mean, the this is the first. Yes. This is the first step of acceleration that I'm describing here. As you can see, some particles can actually get additional energy gain and then lose energy. The first acceleration process that is happening is this process, acceleration at the X point. And once the particles are trapped inside the islands, there are a lot of, like a variety of other processes that can happen and be responsible for additional energization or energy loss. But on average, I don't see particles consistently gaining energy due to any other process, whereas this initial process is what's determining whether a particle will be high in energy or low in energy. So in some sense, it's more fundamental than everything else that is happening afterwards. Okay, and I would like to discuss now a little bit how the conclusions will be changing for a different set of parameters. In particular, in this case, I'm changing the wavelength of the striped region, the wavelength of the stripes, between 20 skin depths. Skin depth is the fundamental plasma scale here, and 1,000, 1,300 skin depths. As you can see, the spectrum for very small wavelengths is close to a Maxwellian, and then as you get higher in wavelength, it resembles this power law tail with an index of 1.5 that I've discussed before. And the same similar trend is observed when changing the magnetization ratio of magnetic energy to kinetic energy of the plasma. For a very high magnetization at fixed wavelength, you get a sort of a thermal distribution or a quasi-Maxwellian distribution. And then as you go lower in magnetization, you get this flat power law tail. So there is a similar trend in the magnetization and in the wavelength. And yes.
So does this change with time?
That's a good point. They don't.
Just by the way, up to when do you trust the simulation?
In time?
Yeah.
So the simulation is actually virtually, you can run the simulation as far as you want, and you won't be limited by time, physical time. You will be limited by computational time. The reason for this is that the boundary of your box on the right side is actually receding from the other side of the speed of light. So you keep everything that is in causal contact with the initial conditions. So we're not limited along that side. We may be limited by the periodicity of the boundary conditions on this side. And in fact, I will be discussing this. But if the box is sufficiently large, and the results that I'm showing here is for a box that is sufficiently large, then you can actually capture the whole physics of the process. The one reason for why these spectra are not evolving in time, especially as compared to what I'll be showing in the later part of my talk, is that the process, the reconnection process is actually completed once the particles are crossing the shock. So there is an upper cutoff in time for the evolution of the spectrum. The spectrum is evolving from the fast shock to the hydro shock, but once it's crossing that, nothing more is happening, and the spectrum freezes. So these spectra are actually computed at the latest time that I have, but from half time to the latest time, they don't actually change in the post-shock region. Okay, similar trend for magnetization and wavelength. And the interesting thing is that you can couple the two parameters and construct the combination of the wavelength divided by the Larmor radius times the magnetization. This is nothing more but the wavelength measured in Larmor radii for the hot particles coming out of reconnection. So the additional factor of sigma is because the particles are getting, on average, an energy gain of sigma. So if you rescale your unit length, keeping into account the fact that the particles are actually hot, are actually getting hotter than they started with, then it makes sense to measure the wavelength in that unit. And if you do so, you can change the magnetization from 100 to 10, and the shape of the particle spectrum, once rescaled by the average energy gain, is actually the same. So there is one single parameter that is controlling the shape of the particle spectrum, and that's the combination of wavelength in units of the hot Larmor radius of accelerated particles in the regime of large magnetizations. Bottom line is that if this parameter is smaller than 10, you have a Maxwellian-like spectrum. If it's larger than 10 ballpark numbers, you have a broad and flat power law tail with an index of 1.5 or so. There are more things that you can change. I will just skip through this for timing reasons. You can change the orientation of your simulation plane with respect to the pulsar wind. What we did so far was pretty close to the equator. You can go below the equator or high above the equator. The structure of the flow is changing a little bit. It preserves some striped structure that was not present before. The interesting thing is for the particle spectrum, in the cases where the simulation plane is very much below the equator, then you see that there is a large discrepancy between the width of the region where the field is positive and where the field is negative, which implies that you can only dissipate a small fraction of the field. A lot of the field is in this non-alternating component that cannot be dissipated. And as a result of this, in the cases where the simulation plane is very close to the equator, you can dissipate all of the energy in the alternating component, which is all of the energy in the fields, and your spectrum is very broad. And then if you progress low in latitude or high above the equator in latitude, then your upper energy cutoff is receding to lower energies.
What simple question is, if I take the artificial case of everything being aligned, would I have the strong cases or are they closed?
No. So the current sheet will be exactly on the midplane,
right,
and it won't be wobbling. So the reason why you get the stripes is because it's wobbling.
Right, but you were saying that before there is only one parameter that governs the behavior. There should also be the parameter of the inclination.
Yes, yes. So that's one parameter for the physics of the reconnection given the inclination. Okay. The inclination is something that pertains to the pulsar physics, and it's like an external parameter, the same as the magnetization or the same as the wavelength, for example. Okay, the special case that I would like to discuss in a little bit more detail is what is happening if you put the simulation plane exactly along the equator. In that case, the region where the field is negative has exactly the same length as the region where the field is positive. This is sort of a special case, and you see that the structure of the flow is actually different. This is the case that we discussed so far, the black line a little bit below the midplane. The stripes are not symmetric, slightly asymmetric. And this is the case for symmetric stripes. What you get in this case is a special behavior for the particles. The particles can actually surf the magnetic stripes and get very far into the upstream. And you see them here in the projection of the particle X momentum as a function of the X location. There is a bunch of particles here that can move very far ahead of the shock, which is not the case here. And the physics is very simple. For those cases, the particles can just do this and surf the magnetic field and get very far upstream of the shock. In the other case, the particle have a finite Larmor radius in the upstream field, and they need to go back into the shock. They are attracted into the shock. They cannot propagate very far from the shock. That's where the difference is in between the two cases. The new thing that you have in the case where the field, where the simulation plane is exactly aligned with the equator, is that you have extra turbulence that those particles are producing in the upstream region. And turbulence is always good with shocks because it's required to mediate the so-called Fermi process, which is a very simple process of particles scattering back and forth across the shock and being energized as a result of the fact that the pre-shock medium and the post-shock medium are moving towards each other. It's the same configuration as a tennis ball that is trapped between two tennis players, or volleyball, between two volleyball players. As the players are approaching each other, then the energy of the ball is going up, just because the two are moving towards each other. The same is happening in shock. The downstream medium and the upstream medium are moving towards each other, the particle energy will go up. And this is the difference of the spectrum taken in the case of a little bit below the midplane, which is shown here as a dotted line, and exactly along the midplane, which is shown as a time evolution here for the different colored solid lines. So this is coming back to your question. the dotted line is actually not evolving over time. Here I'm plotting the maximum energy and it stays pretty constant over time. But for the other cases, the spectrum is actually evolving over time. This is sort of a special case only when the simulation plane is almost exactly along the midplane of the pulsar wind, along the equatorial plane of the pulsar wind, or a little bit below or above that. This upper energy cutoff will be evolving over time to higher and higher energies, and the non-thermal tail can have a slope of 3 or 2.5. So reconnection can give you a slope of 1.5 or so, smaller than 2. This is a different process. This is the so-called Fermi acceleration across the shock, which gives you a slope of 2.5 or 3 or so. Sorry, say it again.
You are saying that you have turbulence only when you are close to the equatorial plane.
The turbulence driven self-consistently by the shock is only close to the equatorial plane, because that's the only case in which the particles can stream ahead of the shock and produce turbulence by streaming ahead of the shock. In the other cases, the particles cannot go beyond the shock. They can still be accelerated by reconnection. The same process of due to reconnection operates everywhere, but they cannot stream ahead of the shock. There is no chance for turbulence to be created ahead of the shock, and this additional process doesn't operate there. Okay, now I'll discuss a little bit about the dimensionality of the problem and how the problem depends on the dimensions of the simulations. And in particular, I would like to mention two different modes that can be excited depending on how is the simulation plane oriented relative to the alternating fields. This is the case that I've discussed so far with the alternating fields that are in the simulation plane. This is the configuration that is the appropriate one to capture the tearing mode. That's the mode that is regulating the reconnection and that I've discussed so far. If the alternating fields are outside the plane, perpendicular to the simulation plane, then a different mode is excited, the so-called drift kink mode. And this is the typical signature of the drift kink mode. It has kinks in the current sheet. So one mode only can be excited given an orientation of the alternating fields relative to the simulation plane. And it's still an open question which mode is going to grow faster in 3D. And not necessarily this is the best question to ask, but which modes is going to dominate eventually in 3D. This is actually the most appropriate question. Before going there, I would like just to briefly show that 2D with a large enough box is required in order to get the physics of reconnection, the physics of the tearing mode being captured correctly. This is the result of my simulations for the same parameters, just changing the transverse size of the box. So by shrinking it, I'm making my simulation more and more 1D. And in 1D, I cannot have the tearing mode. So the tearing mode that is regulating reconnection is at least does need at least 2D in order to be captured properly. So between 800 skin depths, which is the largest box that I've tried, and 400 skin depths, nothing is changing. The two spectra are the same, which is telling me that my simulations are converging relative to the transverse size of the box. But then if you shrink it more and more, then you get one-dimensional results which have nothing to do with the two-dimensional physics. So 2D is required for a tearing mode. If you do your simulations in 1D, you're not going to get the right answer. What about 3D? In 3D, as I said, we'll have the competition of two different modes. The magnetic field being in this plane, alternating, we should expect the tearing instability in this plane and the drift kink instability in this other plane. Now, I'll run the movie. You'll be able to see both. And the structure of the flow as well is the same as in 2D. So we'll have a fast shock that is propagating ahead and starting reconnection. Reconnection is completed at the hydro shock, which is more or less here, and very little magnetic energy is left behind the hydro shock. And here you're able to see both modes. You see the drift kink mode in this plane. It will come up clearly at some point. Here you see the kinks in the current sheet and the tearing mode in this plane with this sequence of islands and X points in between each pair of islands. The basic question that I would like to address now is what is the effect of this on the particle spectrum? And I'm comparing here for one case the particle spectrum obtained for a simulation where the alternating fields are outside of my simulation plane, perpendicular to the simulation plane, This is the correct configuration for capturing the drift kink mode relative to a simulation 2D, but with in-plane magnetic fields. This is the configuration to capture the tearing mode only, and as compared to 3D. So 3D and 2D in plane are basically the same, which is telling me that for this parameter range, the drift kink physics is not affecting that much the results that I have on my particle acceleration and the particle spectrum that I expect from reconnection in stride pulsar winds. So 2D simulations with in-plane magnetic fields are actually a very good proxy for the true 3D physics. This was everything that I had to say about pulsar wind nebulae. I'll just mention here a few astrophysical implications very briefly. We know that we see that we can reproduce the spectrum of with a spectral slope of 1.5, which is good to explain the radio spectrum of the crab. However, we can obtain this broad flat spectrum only for this combination of the wavelength relative to the magnetization being larger than 10. And in the crab, it turns out that for a reasonable value of this parameter kappa, which is the multiplicity of the wind, it says how many particles you have in excess of the minimum number of particles needed to sustain the electromagnetic fields of the pulsar. This number is usually 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th. So this parameter is actually less than unity. And we need it to be larger than unity or larger than 10 in order to make a broad spectrum. So the problem now is understanding whether actually this parameter is well constrained. It's constrained reasonably well on the observational side. There are no theories predicting this. So I think it's still up for discussion what is the correct value for the multiplicity. The other thing is that in the particular configuration where the stripes are symmetric, you have an additional acceleration process, this Fermi process bouncing back and forth across the shock. And in this case, you can have, in addition to the spectrum of reconnection, 1.5, a spectrum in which the slope is larger than 2. And this is good to explain the X-ray part of the spectrum of the crab, whose slope is different than the radio spectrum. So radio spectrum, in my view, is coming from reconnection. The X-ray spectrum is coming from this bouncing back and forth process across the shock. Energy.
And the pictures you were showing, I don't think it was quite 4, it was more like 1 or 2.
So that.
And if you said it doesn't evolve after that.
That's a very good question. The shape of the spectrum is controlled by this parameter. And once you fix this parameter, then the width of the spectrum is a function of your magnetization. And in particular, for a slope that is 1.5 or so, the width of the spectrum goes like the magnetization squared. So given the extent of the spectrum you measure from the photon spectrum, you convert it to a particle spectrum, and then you get an estimate on the magnetization, which is basically unknown. It's a free parameter for the crab.
Well, what kinds of numbers do you need?
10 to the, I think something like 30, 100.
10 to the 30 or 100? No, sorry.
10, sorry, 30 or 100, no. Yeah, 10 to the 30 would be interesting. Okay, and in the last 10 minutes or so, I would like to spend some words on recent work that I've been doing on the case of reconnection applied to jets. The difference here is that with respect to the striped wind case, where we had a sequence of alternating fields, here the attention will be on just a single current sheet evolved to very long times. And there is no shock in this case. No shock is expected in this case. So it's basically a cleaner problem. The correct way to approach this would be to see what is the long-term evolution of the system.
What's the scenario that produces that situation?
That's a good question. So there are different alternatives. The two things that I would suggest is either you have an accretion flow in which the magnetic field is changing polarity at some point. So you create a jet that has one polarity of the toroidal field in the first place, and then at later times it has a different polarity of the toroidal field. And when the two polarities are meeting each other, you'll have dissipation due to a reconnection. The second possibility is that you have kink instabilities in the jet itself. The jet can be prone to kink instabilities, which is like one magnetic loop here and the other magnetic loop here can be displaced. And in the middle region, your fields may be having a different polarity at that point, and they may be reconnected. These are the two options that I have in mind. This is the setup of the simulation. The magnetic field alternating, this is 2D so far, magnetization of 10. We start from a very small box, and then the box is actually enlarging over time on the two sides, the same as before. And we follow the reconnection process to long time. So you see this emergence of the islands. The islands are merging, proceeding to larger scale. The reconnection process continues up to the point in which you're left just with one island in your box. And at that point, you cannot trust your simulation anymore because the periodicity of your boundaries along this direction will matter at that point. So it's not good anymore to capture the long-term evolution of your system. What I would like to emphasize here is that the reconnection process is very structured. And in particular, when you merge two islands, you actually have another reconnection layer in between. So this island has a field spiraling around in one direction, and this one, it's in a different direction. And in between, the two fields are actually have opposite polarity. You create a current layer in between, and these small dots are actually islands, magnetic islands that are coming out of that reconnection layer. So it's sort of a fractal process. You have a reconnection layer here, and then you have another perpendicular reconnection layer, you have other perpendicular reconnection layers, and so on and so forth. Just for like terminology reasons, this is called anti-reconnection, but the physics is basically the same as the true reconnection process. What is the long-term evolution in terms of particle spectrum? Here I'm plotting the spectrum as a function of time. In the current sheet layer, you see that the spectrum is evolving over time, and eventually it will get to a power law with a slope of 2 or so. So this is the long-term evolution of the system. You generically create a power law with an index of 2 or so. The maximum energy is evolving over time, and it's increasing linearly with time. In shocks, as I discussed yesterday, the usual behavior that you get is a maximum energy that grows as the square root of time. So it's slower than here. This process is actually more efficient and more promising for explaining fast acceleration over short time scales. The physics of the acceleration is similar. This is basically the similar plot that I've shown before, just one current sheet in this case. Yellow particles and red particles are selected depending on their final energy. And the yellow particles will get their energy by interacting with the X point and then be advected into the island. The red particles, instead, are not interacting with the X point. They're just being trapped inside the island without any additional energy gain. So the X point physics and the reconnection electric field at the X point is of paramount importance for the acceleration of the particles. This is just one detailed point on the structure of the spectrum. In principle, if you look at something like this, you're not sure whether each generation of particles is giving you a non-thermal spectrum in the first place, or this non-thermal spectrum is just a superposition of different Maxwellians injected at different times. What we're looking at here is like a Eulerian perspective, and we want to follow particles in a Lagrangian way to see what is their spectrum after the interaction with the current sheet. And this is shown here. We followed 10,000 particles here or so over time, and the spectrum at late times after they interact with the current sheet is in itself a power law with a slope of 2 or so. So the spectrum of a Lagrangian set of particles followed over time is the same spectrum of a Eulerian snapshot of the current sheet at a given time. The dependence on the magnetization can be simply scaled with this factor of sigma. So larger magnetization, you get higher cutoff energies just because you have more energy available for the dissipation. But once you rescale, taking that into account, the spectra are actually very similar. And
So in your 2D simulations, like if you increase the density of the collisionless plasma, do you just rescale the movie?
The density is doesn't enter directly into the simulations.
Because you're plotting the distance as like C over omega.
Yes.
So does it just like rescale what you
do? So the density enters only as a you can either change the density or change the charge of your particles such that to keep the scale, the C over omega P scale the same. So the density doesn't enter directly as a parameter in the simulation. I don't need to choose the density being the density of some astrophysical object. The density enters as a scaling factor, if you want. So all of the simulation can be rescaled to whatever density I think for a given object, provided that I know what the plasma skin depth for that object is.
No, I mean, like in your simulation, have you checked if you, like, for example, increase?
Oh, the computational density of particles. That's what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, if you increase this density, do you just get the same thing with just
scaling? Yes. Actually, if you fix the scale, then the density doesn't matter. But if you put more particles per cell, then all of the spectra will just be increased by that factor. Okay, and one final word on the 3D in this case as well. This is a huge 3D simulation of a single current sheet. We should expect a drift kink mode in this plane, the tearing mode in this plane. In addition to the alternating component, I also have a component of guide field. Here, the guide field is a field that is perpendicular to the alternating component, uniform across the layer. The results are not actually dependent on that, but in this particular case, I had that guide field as well. So this is the evolution of the system. I'll stop it here for the moment. You see the drift kink mode operating here with characteristic kinks. There are islands on this side separated by X points, so you see the physics of both modes. And then if you evolve it to longer time, then you forget about the drift kink mode. So the drift kink mode won't be shaping the evolution of the system for longer times. The tearing mode will dominate at longer time. So the structure of the reconnection layer will be dominated by the tearing mode eventually, even if the drift kink mode may be the fastest to grow in the first place. The same physics for the spectrum is obtained in 3D relative to 2D, similar slope, similar evolution of the maximum energy over time. And I will conclude with some implication for AGN jets. We have studied a configuration for reconnection that may be relevant, should be relevant for dissipation in active galactic nuclei jets, both for the acceleration of the emitting electrons and for the origin of ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. And maybe with reconnection, we can explain the fast variability that is observed in AGN jets. This is variability on long time scales. You see how the spectrum can change a lot from one epoch to the next, but there's actually variability on very small 20-minute time scale, and maybe reconnection can have a role in explaining that. And I will summarize here. For pulsar winds, reconnection can give spectra with an index of, with a slope of 1.5, which is the correct one to explain the radio spectrum. We might have problems in the sense that for the multiplicity that we believe is present in pulsar winds, the spectrum may not be as broad as we're getting in our simulations. But I view this as a challenge for the magnetospheric physics of the pulsar wind to be able to assess what is the right value for the multiplicity. And in jets, we obtain this slope of 2 or so with a maximum energy that is growing linearly with time, which is very promising for the acceleration of electrons and ultra-energy protons that we observe at Earth. And let me just finish with one quick comment about why reconnection or how reconnection might be relevant for gravitational wave signals or electromagnetic precursors of gravitational wave signals. This is a simulation that Luis and Carlos Palenzuela performed this year with two neutron stars merging, with a magnetic two magnetized neutron stars merging. The magnetic field of the two stars is such that reconnection will be triggered in between the two stars, and the magnetic topology will be rearranged with one single loop encompassing the two stars as a result of reconnection. So reconnection is definitely operating in this system, most likely to be relativistic reconnection. The magnetic fields of neutron stars is very large compared to the rest mass energy of the pairs in the magnetosphere. So a clear assessment of the role of reconnection in shaping the non-thermal emission is required if we want to understand what is the optical or electromagnetic counterpart of gravitational wave sources or gravitational wave signals. And a kinetic description of the reconnection process is required in order to understand this from first principles. And I will stop here.
case of the point-dominated jets, right, so you discussed two possible scenarios that you have thought of, that you would have this, perhaps, induce this current sheet along the jet. So presumably, not all point-dominated, all jets out there have this feature. So if we can we actually go to observation and see that some, there's a kind of a subclass of the, of those jets that may have a closer relevance to these, and or alternatively, kind of if they all more or less share the same feature to say, well, this is the way to do it, or this actually does not have a connection with reality.
So my motivation for thinking about such a configuration is that the alternative would be for dissipation. So my approach is think where dissipation can happen. If you have a pointing dominated jet and you have no alternation, or no changes in the field polarity, then one option for dissipation would be to have internal shocks in a strongly magnetized fluid. Those shocks are very weak, and even if the magnetic field is only slightly dominating the energy of the particles, those shocks are known not to be efficient particle accelerators for generic configurations. Like large magnetization shocks with perpendicular field perpendicular to the shock normal, we don't get particle acceleration for such shocks. So we don't get dissipation in some sense. We don't get non-thermal emission. Magnetic reconnection would be a more promising way of having dissipation and non-thermal emission, but you need to assume that your jet is not very structured, in the sense not a very ordered field, but it has some changing in the polarity of the field on the way. If that's not an option, I don't know which other mechanisms for dissipation or which other configurations for dissipation may be realized in jets. We may be...
Right, when I'm trying to ask a kind of this observational question, not knowing anything.
So in some jets we do see, for example, in AGN jets, we do see changes in the Faraday rotation for different blobs. So different blobs may be carrying fields of different polarity, which would be a configuration that is good for dissipating this energy with reconnection. I don't think there is any signature of a jet that is bright in one blob and showing a polarity on one side of the blob and a different polarity on the other side of the blob. But I may be wrong.
There are rotation measure gradients in lots of different directions, in lots of different blobs. One of the key difficulties, though, is jets for which there are polarization typically are blazers.
Yeah.
So they're typically pointing nearly at it. So that means that when you see a gradient across, this is a, it's just a little bit hard to see gradients here. On the other hand, a lot of AGN jets, especially in the optical, show knots. Mm-hmm. And from the very fact that you're seeing knots and not this one extended thing, means that you have to have particle acceleration sites along the jet. So whether or not those are related to reconnection is not known, but certainly they're localized acceleration.
Right, but so yeah, but it was that crazy. If I take, there is a prediction here of particular power that they have. So now if I go and look at the signatures, do they all show hints of this power law, or their picking classes and then showing it and then not, in which case then I could say, well, maybe these are explained by these methods that they are what there's something else.
So you're asking what kind of power laws are needed in practice and whether or not
I think is consistent with the observation.
Around 2 is a good number. There are some jets that are showing a break in the particle distribution that you need with flatter than 2, lower than GeV energies for the electrons, and steeper than 2, higher than that. The power law is around 2. It changes a little bit with magnetization. So if you have different regions with different magnetizations and different by a factor of 2, you may have both the coexistence of power laws that are flatter than that and steeper than that. But I would say that in general, you need something around 2. And in fact, shocks were initially proposed as being responsible for the acceleration of particles giving rise to the non-thermal emission, because relativistic shocks in general give something like 2 or 2.5 or so. So in this case, since the reconnection is also giving something that is close to what shocks would do, even though the physics is totally different.
So you show 2 different setups, right? The striped and the single interface. And I guess the difference between the striped and the single interface is in the single interface, particles are always being brought back because they're subject to a uniform field on the other side. So I imagine that's why you get continuing acceleration. How sensitive are your results to the particular geometry that you start with? And in particular, you know, the real question I have in mind is how can I x-appropriate your results to, say, reconnection in a turbulent accretion disk or something? There we don't have an isoplanar shock. It's not ordered in a striped fashion, and you know, we'll have transient events. And, you know, is there a simple way for me to take your results and just immediately graph them onto that, or is that hopeless?
So if you, in some sense, an upper limit to this picture is given by whatever scale is the scale of your alternating fields or your fields of opposite polarity. Okay? In this case, you're assuming that the field is perfectly linear and perfectly reversing, possibly with some additional component of a perpendicular field, perpendicular to both. Okay? So I think this is a generic configuration. If you go to sufficiently small scales, then the turbulence that is giving rise to the reconnection as a scale that is much larger than the scale that I'm resolving here. And then you can apply in this physics on these small scales and say, if my reconnection is allowed to proceed up to the scale of my turbulence, then this is the spectrum that I should get. And the scale of the turbulence will effectively act such that to limit your maximum energy, such that reconnection cannot proceed up like to times larger than that, because at that point the fields are not alternating anymore on like a simply planar geometry. So it will get in as a dynamical scales or a upper dynamical time scales, length scales or time scales that will limit the acceleration on the larger scales. But the small scale physics that is seeding this in the first place will still operate. So in some sense, you'll be truncating your evolution to higher and higher energies at some point, which is driven and informed by the turbulence structure, unless you have turbulence on microscopic scales. But that's a different issue, and I'm not sure how strong of a turbulence you'll have at that point.
Well, you have turbulence on the scale of the shock that you put in, right? I mean, it develops. That's what the
Turing
mode. And
no. The turbulence that you have in the accretion disk could be on the MRI scale, which is typically larger than this. So if there is a cascade of turbulence from the MRI scale down to the micro scales that we're dealing with here, then the question is how much turbulence you're left with on those scales.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Lorenzo again.
Thank you.